So I'm going to talk tonight, continue our conversation tonight about the quality of selflessness or anatta, and particularly how it relates to the Buddhist ideas or doctrines around rebirth. In a very simple way, and in perhaps a way that I'm going to challenge or take apart in just a moment, a simplistic version of the Buddhist idea around rebirth, one common sort of mainstream Buddhist idea about rebirth, at least in the Theravada, is that our current body is only the most current of something like infinite series of past births, where we, without in quotation marks, I, have experienced life in many different kinds of bodies and places, human, animals, spirit realms, and that the progression through these different births and realms is largely directed by my own actions. So the doctrine of rebirth is intrinsically an ethical doctrine. It's not even as much a cosmological doctrine. It has that side, and you can interpret it as having that side. There are heaven realms and hells and ghost realms and, you know, animal realm and human realm that one could get born into. And we are born into these various realms, based on our own actions. And there's commentary, you know, in the discourses. There's discourses themselves that suggest that some of the early thinking on this was, in a certain way, fairly straightforward. In that one's birth might have a direct relationship with the actions that you took in the previous birth to get you there. There's a sutta in which two ascetic practitioners come to the Buddha. One of them does the practice of acting like a dog all the time, and the other one does the practice of acting like an ox all the time. And so they try to do exactly what these animals do. And, you know, it's a painful ascetic practice, crawling around on all fours, eating dog food with your mouth, et cetera, et cetera. And the Buddha teaches them, but they ask, you know, is our practice going to be liberative? Is it going to succeed? And the Buddha initially doesn't want to answer them. I think he knows he's going to hurt their feelings, but they press him, and he says, the only possible result of practicing in such a way is to be reborn as a dog and an ox. So there's this very direct relationship between their actions in this life and actions in a later life. And the texts go through a number of direct parallels. You know, being stingy in one life leads to being ugly in the next life, and, you know, things like that. And so there's definitely an aspect of the classical teachings that that certainly over time was interpreted very literally, you know, very much as a material, like, I am reborn as this and this and this and this. And one of the challenges with this, of course, is that the Buddha was South Asian, and South Asian tradition outside of Buddhism developed its own ideas about rebirth that are quite different. So in the Bhagavad Gita, the blessed song, beloved of the Hindu religion, particularly Vedanta, in that text, the teaching is that the soul, the Atman, the Pali word would be Atta, the thing that you can't find, that's why Anatta, but the Hindu teaching, the Vedanta teaching, is that the soul puts on and takes off bodies like outfits of clothing. When a body wears out, it discards it like an old suit and then puts on a new one. This is, but that there's a there's a continuity running through it, which is this soul, that there is a being, a soul, that that wears bodies like clothing, but the soul is essentially immortal, and realization in those systems, a simplistic way of talking about realization or liberation in those systems is that the soul realizes that being immortal and ultimately untouched by the sorrows of any given body, it is functionally not different from or ontologically not separate from God themself, Brahma. So then Atman is not separate from Brahma. So that's an idea about reincarnation, and a lot of teachers I know use the word reincarnation to point to the Hindu version and rebirth to point to the Buddhist version. That's artificial because they're both translations, but I'll do that. The Buddhist idea is different, that rebirth happens based in conditions, and the conditions that come into being with the next birth, they carry the karmic imprint of the last birth. Karmic really means your actions. So they carry the ethical action imprint of your last birth and previous ones. But there's no, you know, soul, there's no Atman that experiences those things, right? In just the same way that my mind states right now carry the karmic imprint of my 40s and 30s and 20s. Talk about age, since it's just been my birthday. The dependent arising that is Sean at 53 carries the karmic imprint of the dependent arising that was Sean at 43, 13, 3, 0, whatever. But is not exactly the same. And the inquiry is, can you find the atta? It's the Where's Waldo of Buddhist practice. Can you find the soul in anything? Right? Can I find it in the body? Well, the body keeps changing, right? If you disassemble the body, where was the soul living? You know? And so this proposes this brings up a conversation between materialist philosophies that think that the only things that exist must be measurable in the physical world, and philosophies that understand that experiences aren't necessarily physical and there are things that cannot be measured in the physical. This was the gist of a conversation that I had on Facebook last week or the week before with this like militant atheist who just dismissed the Buddhist ideas, you know, out of hand without really inquiring into them as being essentially fantasy or imagination. You know, you can imagine that you're experiencing your past lives, but there's no, you know, you can't reproduce that experiment. There's no provable hypothesis. So it's essentially no more real than a dream. So this is a very old conversation. And there are discourses in the canon where the Buddha has conversations with materialist ascetics. And one of these ascetics actually describes some experiments that he says he did. I'm inclined to think that these were thought experiments rather than real physical ones. If they were real physical ones, I have compassion for the subjects of these experiments. But they describe a king wanting to discover if there was a soul in the body. And so taking a thief who was to be put to death and doing various experiments like weighing the thief very precisely and then killing them and then weighing them again to see if they were any lighter after death, because then you might get a weight amount for the soul. There's a contemporary movie 20 years ago or so that had the same premise, that there was some amount of grams, 23 grams or something, that was supposedly the soul that disappeared at the moment of death. One of the experiments narrated in this sutta is, they said like, well, let's put a guy in a pot and seal it around so no steam can escape and then cook him and see if, you know, the soul escapes through the steam in some way. So these are a bit grotesque, but they point to this conversation happening for a long time around, like, how do we think in a materialistic way about the nature of the soul, the nature of the self, and the nature of that which is reborn. The way that I want to touch into it tonight is not to start with the doctrine that we are reborn again and again based on our actions. Now, you know that's what it is, but I'm going to rewind not to to go from that into somehow proving it, which is difficult to do, particularly from a materialistic perspective, but to go backwards, as we did in our sharing, to say that it's clear in many, many cultures around the world, Buddhist and non-Buddhist, including atheistic cultures, non-theistic cultures, indigenous and post-indigenous cultures, that people have experiences that could be explained by the doctrines in rebirth. They remember being someone else, or they have a felt sense of being someone else. Some of you described things like this. Some of the most compelling have been collected in recent times by a researcher named Ian Stevenson. And if you're interested, I encourage you to look up his work. He started collecting stories of children who remembered past lives, and particularly stories that could be corroborated. So stories where a child says, I lived in this place, and these were my relatives. And then they would go to those places, find those people, and they would say, like, oh yeah, we had a relative whose name was such and such, and they died at, you know, such and such a time, you know, right before this child was born, you know. And there's some really interesting details that some of those stories have. One of them is that there's a whole subset of cases where people described remembering their death being violent, being cut with a blade, hit with an axe, shot through with a gun. There might seem to be a preponderance of those in the evidence. We might not be surprised by that, knowing that traumatic experiences imprint themselves in memory more strongly than pleasant or neutral ones. And so it's going to be harder to remember a peaceful death than a violent one. But more interesting and mysterious is that in quite a number of these cases where someone remembers a violent death preceding this life, there's all these cases where people have a birthmark on their current body in exactly the place and shape of the traumatic injury. So they'll say, oh, I was hit with a head with an axe, and they'll look under their hair, and there's a scar line that's not a scar but a birthmark in that shape. Or they'll say, I was shot in this place, and there's a round birthmark in that place on the body. So that's mysterious. There's a very interesting case, and if you want to look at some of this research from a Buddhist monk who really tried to look very carefully at the evidence, you could look at Bhikkhu Anālaya's book, Rebirth in, what's it called? I have it open here. Rebirth in Early Buddhism and Current Research. So this book goes through the Buddhist doctrines of rebirth, goes through Ian Stevenson's work and some of those really interesting case studies, and it has one full case study itself in the end, which is the case study of a really interesting person who's still alive. Their name is Dhammaruwan. They're Sri Lankan. And this is the case study of a person who, as a young child, a lay person, spontaneously started chanting in Pali. And his parents recorded his chanting. And they weren't a particularly Buddhist family. He's in a Buddhist country. But they recorded it. It was far more elaborate than you would think a 3 or 4 or 5 year old would be able to memorize from just having overheard the monks in this life. And what Anālaya does in this book is he actually listens to the tapes. You can get those tapes and listen to them. They're floating around online. You can find those recordings. If you can't find them, ring me, I have them. You know, it just sounds like a person chanting in Pali. You might not notice anything about it, but Anālio analyzes them, and he particularly analyzes the mistakes in them, because a couple things are noticeable from the chanting. One is that it's not exactly the same as any contemporary version of these texts, and the ways that it diverges are really interesting. Like, there's places where it's clear that he skips over like a stock phrase and then adds in a different stock phrase that probably would go there. In other words, he's doing what oral tradition people would do when they're when they've memorized these texts, is that you're going through your set of stock phrases, and so you remember kind of the outline, and then you plug in the stock phrases that fit. And the places where he makes, where Damaruan makes mistakes, are mistakes that only could happen if the version of the text was different from the contemporary one. And they can, and he could track what the mistake was and what it might be referring to, what he might actually have been remembering in that moment, and comes to the conclusion that these are versions of the text that were coherent with 4th and 5th century recitation. Damaruan eventually, they kind of suggest that he is remembering being the, you know, having been a monk in these early days of the Sri Lankan transmission, around when the commentaries were written, in the 4th or 5th century of the Common Era. So again, that's a really interesting case. He got a whole bunch of media attention early on, and possibly because of that, the chanting stopped happening. But he eventually went and ordained as a monk, and he's a monk now, studying and just being, you know, I don't know, back home. I wonder how it feels. So all of that is some of the research. And so there are, you know, materialistic explanations. But again, set aside the explanations, and let's start with the direct experience. It seems to happen that at various times folks can remember something that seems like not themselves. And even that word remember, watch out for that word, right? That's already implying a meaning, saying that like, oh yeah, we know that this was in the past, because it feels like memory. But what if we say that a person is having a vision or an intuitive experience, or this word is imprecise because it specifically refers to Central Asian indigenous practice, but having a kind of shamanic experience. And in thinking about this, I got to thinking a bit about how we, how some of us might hold differently the kind of material that comes up in a psychedelic trip. So if you take, you know, if you take any of a class of psychedelics, could be like LSD or psilocybin or DMT or ketamine in some cases, you can have experiences that feel real, are extraordinary in terms of having really different sensations and experiences than you're used to in your regular life, and even that can have very salutary effects on your well-being. You can realize something about yourself, your life, about interconnectedness, about the nature of the universe. You might realize that the universe is a certain way that you hadn't really connected with before. What's happening here, right? Because from to be purely phenomenological, we have to say, which means like going solely with direct experience, we would have to say there are sensations and sensory experiences, you know, there's visual experiences, auditory experiences, somatic experiences that are out of the ordinary, right? That are unusual to us, that have a kind of energy to them, and that with them can often come a kind of information, right? So what is it, what's it like when you get a hit of intuitive information? And in a way, this inquiry applies throughout the Buddhist teachings on what an insight is. You know, what is it to have the insight into impermanence? Because remember that like you can observe impermanence easily, right? Obviously everything is changing. But there's something different about getting a hit that because I can observe everything changing, it must be true that everything always changes and that there's no exceptions to the everything changing principle, right? So that's the leap that we make cognitively, emotionally, spiritually, right? Is that we go from a direct experience to a description of how things are, of the nature of things. And to the extent that that interpretive leap feels right to us, those experiences can completely change one's life. And those experiences are what we call enlightenment, right? Or insight, transformative insight. You really saw impermanence. You really saw or felt anatta. You really saw or felt emptiness. And the result of that is that your life changes forever, right? You can have a psychedelic trip and the result of which is that your life changes forever. There's no materialistic proof that the universe is, you know, a scintillating interconnected mass of benevolent rainbows, as you might experience, you know, under the influence of some psychedelics. But experiencing the universe as a scintillating interconnected mass of benevolent rainbows could really work for you in terms of unseating some ideas about yourself or ideas about suffering or the experience of suffering. Those experiences can be substantial. And the experiences that come in meditation can likewise be substantial. The experiences that come as a result of concentration, like coming through the setting down of the hindrances and into spaces of profound ease and stability of heart and mind, the sense of being free from anxiety, free from stress, and then going into the immaterial attainments, free even from the constrictions of material form. Those experiences are internal, they're conditioned, they're in a certain way idiosyncratic. You can tell somebody what it was like. Oh my God, I was resting in the base of infinite consciousness, you know, the sixth jhana or the sixth level of, you know, immersion. And someone else can, you know, can be like, you know, kind of like the first guy the Buddha saw on the road after his enlightenment. The Buddha was like, I'm the world teacher. I've realized full liberation. And the guy said, good for you, friend, and walked on. You know, you can't convince anyone of the validity of your mystical experience. The proof in the pudding is your own happiness, is your own freedom from suffering. And so what if then the experiences of feeling like someone else are like this, that through various pathways, and particularly through the concentration and inquiry pathway, that's the favorite pathway in the Dharma anyway, it's possible to have these experiences of getting a glimpse into feeling like someone else. What the Buddha does is he proposes a particular interpretive leap. And the interpretive leap is that those visions or the felt sense of being someone else, that is myself in a past life. So the Buddha says, and the grammar is myself, right? It says, I saw my own previous births. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 100, 1,000, 100,000 past births, cosmic eons expanding and contracting. One interesting thing about the past births doctrine is that when the Buddha describes his own, and in the stock phrase that describes the insight into the past births, it goes very quickly from recent definable past births. You know, I was hit with an axe and I have a birthmark on my head. And before that I was, you know, I was a monk some hundreds of years ago. You know, those kinds of memories. It goes very quickly from that into like, I remembered 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, countless cosmic eons of existence. The Theravadan assumption is that this is shorthand for the Buddha concretely remembering the material realities of all of these. But of course, he's describing an infinite range. And so there's another leap that happens, that again happens when we have an insight, where we leap from the specific to the general, right? I see impermanence and I know that it's true everywhere. I have a sense of selflessness and I get the hit that it's true for everything everywhere. I see some past lives and I understand that that sequence goes on forever back into the past. That's the proposal. So that's the first insight that the Buddha has. And that's the interpretive leap, really two leaps that that insight makes. One is that it generalizes from seeing some births to an infinite stretch, right? The texts will say that the beginning of time is unseeable. There's no conceivable beginning to the universe. The second leap is from the individual to the collective, right? Because it's like this for me, because this feels right to me, this must also be how it is for others. And this is really spelled out in the discourses. This is called the Tevidya, or the three Tevidya, Tevidya, the three knowledges. These are the three insight knowledges the Buddha has on his night of awakening. He first sees previous lives or past births. Past homes is another way to interpret this, to translate that. Then he sees how beings, other beings, appear and disappear in accordance with their actions, their karma. So the first insight is personal, seeing the past, and it stretches way into the infinite past. So there's an understanding that the principle I see in the last several lifetimes is continuous into the, you know, beginningless past. And the second interpretive leap is that this is also true for others. And this second insight relies on one of the Buddha's core skills, and you could also say practices, that again, in a, you know, we don't emphasize as much in kind of pragmatic contemporary Dharma teaching, but his clairvoyance. So the Buddha has the power to see the past and future of other beings. He doesn't predict the future so much. He says the future will arise as a result of conditions and actions, but he can see people's past, karmically what led them to this place, and he can see the potential for their future, like he did with the dog duty ascetic, the ascetic pretending to be a dog, and he's like, the only place this leads is rebirth as a dog, man. And the ascetic immediately starts crying. They become monks, they do fine, they get enlightened. But I'm sure that was scary to hear. But the Buddha also does this many times in the texts where he declares rebirths. So people will come to him and they'll say, such and such person just died. Where did they get reborn? And the Buddha will look out with his clairvoyance and say, oh, they got reborn in, you know, the Tusita heaven realm, or as a potter, or as a, in this or that realm, they're a ghost, they're in hell, they're in heaven. So he has this ability then to observe others, the minds and the karmic streams of others. Again, that's a supernatural explanation for something that I want to keep coming back to, like the direct experience of, like, oh, I have the experience of being someone else. And, you know, and there's various ways that you can interpret this. There are other cultures who have rebirth doctrines, whose rebirth doctrines are entirely about ancestry. So, you know, new babies are, you know, beloved, you know, grandparents or, you know, ancestors returned. There's a number of indigenous cultures whose cosmology really maps in this circle between this, the visible world, and a kind of invisible world, a world of the ancestors. And the ancestors return in the form of visible beings with new births. And so that's a different model for how this works. And you can see that all of these different models, like there's a soul that puts on different bodies like articles of clothing. There's a cycle in which ancestors return in the bodies of new children. Or the Buddhist idea, you know, there's a stream of action that coalesces as new bodies, and that one, when one removes oneself entirely from creating new birth tending karma, like as long as one, if you can get to the experience of no longer wanting in a very deep way further experience, you will not give rise to the conditions of further birth. All of these are different. They're all interpretive narratives of the experience of feeling like, oh, I've been someone else. And I think you could call, I think to be really cross-cultural here, it's interesting to not assume any of those cultural or interpretive frameworks immediately. Of course, like if you're from a culture that holds one and it's close to your people, then it's appropriate to hold that one close and to really investigate it and be in it. And, you know, but all interpretive frameworks, all narratives are cultural, which means they're conditioned, they change over time. You know, the ancient Indian Vedic culture was not a rebirth culture. It did not teach that souls were reborn. That appeared later, and it may have even appeared as a response to the Buddha's proposal, which was quite radical. In the Vedic culture, so like 1,000 years before the time of the Buddha, the Vedas just talk about people who die going to the land of the fathers. It actually sounds much more like one of those ancestral cycle kinds of models than the later Vedanta model, where there's a soul that's immortal and, you know, inseparable from but distinct from, because illusion, Brahma, who then, you know, puts on and off bodies like old suits. And so if we set aside the various cultural frameworks, we have the mystery of this kind of experience that happens to folks, and how we hold mystical experience, I think, is what this is really talking about. How do we understand the relationship between, you know, traumatic memory and consciousness as consciousness is represented beyond this physical body? How do we understand our connection to our blood ancestors, our cultural ancestors, our spiritual ancestors, and being, you know, somehow related to them? The Buddhist teacher Dipa Ma had the ability, she said, to remember her previous births. And she wanted to hear the Buddha speak directly in his own language. And she had the felt sense that she had been there, that she had been a monastic or a layperson, you know, in the presence of the Buddha. And so she remembered her way all the way back to the time of the Buddha and said that she could remember listening to the Buddha teaching. And someone asked her, like, how do you do that? And she said, mind moment by mind moment. There's a way that the perfection of mindfulness, which is a characteristic of the fourth jhana, very deep absorption, concentration, the perfection of mindfulness is, like I said in the beginning, it's not separate from the perfection of memory, right? And there's also the aspect of like remembering the texts in an oral tradition where mindfulness was also associated with what it would be like to remember, you know, like, if you were a reciter of the Digha Nikaya, you could remember the entire long discourses. What would that be like? What kind of mindfulness would one have to be able to remember a text that long precisely? And what if that is actually the same, what if that's the same quality that one uses to walk one's way back into the past to remember? The last thing I'll propose here is that what if most of us can't remember the past because there's been so much trauma, not just in this life, but in many previous lives? And again, this touches onto ancestral trauma and you know, generational trauma. Such that if in our previous lives we had no mindfulness, if there was no sense of clear memory, like if things were disrupted enough in the psyche that we couldn't clearly, be mindful of things, then perhaps all that comes through is flickers of trauma, the tiny bits of wounding that survive a very fractured psyche. If that's true for individuals or for a culture, I would expect a kind of cultural amnesia, a lack of memory, not really understanding that we have been there for these, for the past. And so perhaps the Buddhist proposal that mindfulness enables memory of past lives will only be provable by you in your next lifetime, because in this lifetime you've been drawn to practice, you've found the Dhamma, and you are being mindful. And to the extent your mindfulness is strong in this lifetime, you are actually planting the seeds for these moments to be remembered later. And so then, being able to remember these moments later may mean that in a subsequent birth, or whatever that means in the distant future after the death of this body, that these experiences will be memorable by someone who might say, oh, I remember being in this kind of body. I remember practicing in this kind of sangha. I remember being in this kind of home, eating this kind of food, having these kind of friends, this kind of livelihood, and dying in this way. And the instruction to stay really alert as we approach death, so as to remember it, because remembering it apparently is a very powerful experience to have on the path to liberation. All right, there's a bit of that. Thank you for listening so warmly.